really the beginning of his humiliation. And some of the things that happen and transpire, of course, as relayed not just by John, but the other Gospels, really are quite amazing. And we know what's going to happen. I think we suggested on last week that one of the amazing things is that Jesus knew what was going to happen. And maybe I overemphasize that in my own mind, but to me, that is just a fascinating thing, that Jesus knew what was coming, and he was willing to go through it anyway. And so it's one thing to know in general what's going to happen, but the record said he knew all things that were going to happen. And so that's, to me, incredible. But all of that is coming, and it's remarkable. One of the things we'll point out to me, not only did Jesus know everything was coming, let's not forget who he is and what he is. We've seen throughout John that he is God manifested in the flesh. And so for him to endure the kind of things that he's about to start enduring here is really quite amazing, that he allowed himself to be treated in the fashion that they're going to treat him, and did so basically with a very calm spirit and without losing his temper, without obviously reacting in a violent way. He could have, as he himself said, could call the legions of angels from heaven. And we like to quote that passage and because that's what he said. But truth is, he is the Son of God. He could have just spoken the word and destroyed his persecutors. But he demonstrated to me the greatest bit of self-control that could ever be demonstrated by allowing these ones who were so beneath him, who were his creation, to treat him in the way that we're going to begin seeing here, beginning with John. And John doesn't get into the details of that. We'll flip over at appropriate times to some of the other Gospels, because we certainly don't want to skip over some of the things that he suffered and how he was treated. But John doesn't deal with all of it. It's remarkable that John doesn't deal with some of those things, because he was an eyewitness of a lot of things that transpired. But his main purpose is to elevate Christ and demonstrate his deity. The other Gospels really emphasize the suffering Savior. And so while John does depict some suffering, some of the things that happened to him, obviously, being crucified, he doesn't go into that, the detail that the other Gospels do with regard to that. But it all begins right here. When this band of soldiers, then their captain, the officers of the Jews, arrested him, and of course it says they bound him. Was it necessary for them to bind him up? No. Now, they wouldn't know that, of course. That was a typical thing to do. They're misguided in every way. And everything almost that they do from this time forward is either wrong and lacked integrity or was flat out illegal. And so we know that. But, I mean, we can't attribute everything to that. Like, if you're going to arrest somebody, binding them up is the typical thing to do. What they didn't realize was Jesus wasn't going to put up any kind of resistance at all, because he knew why he was there. Remember in John chapter 12, that he, I think 27, verse 27, 26, 27, right in there somewhere, where he said, "For this very reason I came to this hour." He knew he was here to die. That might explain some of his calmness and how he reacted when they were mistreating him. Again, he knew it was coming, but he was there. He was going through all that because that was God's plan of salvation. It was foreordained. It was a part of the foreknowledge of God for him to go through all of that. And him being the Son of God, again, he realizes all of that. So that might attribute to how he reacted to some of these things. But they don't realize all of that. They don't know he's not going to put up any resistance. So they bind him. And it says first they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. And I think we sort of closed at that point last week, emphasizing that really Caiaphas was the high priest, but Annas had the power. And the reason for that was because many scholars tell us that he was brilliant as a high priest. maybe one of the greatest high priests that the Jews had. He was clever. He was intelligent. He knew how to deal with Rome particularly well. We're also told that he was a little satanic in his mentality and his behavior. He wasn't a nice guy, but he was very powerful, and the people loved him. And so the Jews loved him and respected him. And so he was replaced. He was removed from office. And of course, we know the Jewish law. That's, you know, you're high priest for life. So, but when the Jews are under Roman authority and power, so if they decide to do something, then that's what's done. And so they removed him. And so he's no longer high priest, but the people really viewed him as the legitimate high priest, though Caiaphas technically was the high priest. And that's why you see, like, it doesn't, even in Acts chapter 4, I think it is, Annas is directly, he's called the high priest by the inspired pen of Luke. But you have to know the history there. He was not the high priest. So why did Luke say that by inspiration? Because that's how he was viewed. Luke was just writing from the vantage point of the Jews and their attitude towards it. So, but all of that plays a part in this. Because why in the world would they lead Jesus to Annas? Which, by the way, John is the only one that gives us that information. The other Gospels don't even mention that. But why would he do that? It was because of who he was and the respect that he had from among the people. So Jesus is going to actually be questioned by Annas. Now, it can't be anything official, because he's not really the high priest. So anything that is discovered, anything that he finds out, which we'll discover here in just a second, he didn't find anything out. But even if he were to find something out, he wouldn't be able to do much with the information except pass it on to Caiaphas, who then would have to report it to the Roman authorities, because technically Caiaphas was the high priest. So they lead him to Annas. And I might point out, I don't know if I made the point last week, that maybe the reason he continued to have clout is because the next four, after he was removed, the next four high priests were his sons. And then now Caiaphas is his son-in-law. And in fact, the evidence is that he, obviously they led him there. It sounds as if, and most scholars conclude, that he actually has his residence in the place that was really reserved for the high priest. So like, you know, so he was high priest almost in every way except for an official title. So that's what's going on here. But they lead him to him. At verse 14, it mentions, because Caiaphas is mentioned, we're told it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Remember that back in 11? What does that tell you about this situation from the very beginning? Now, he's going to be interviewed. He's going to be interrogated by Annas, but then taken over to Caiaphas. You think, are you thinking, boy, he gets to Caiaphas, he's really the high priest, Jesus is going to be in good shape, he's going to get a fair hearing before. You think that? He's going before a man who's already concluded and told the Jews, remember the Jews are having trouble, what should we do with Jesus? And basically, Caiaphas rebuked them. Like, why are you even thinking about this? It is expedient that one man should die, then all the people perish. So there is no doubt what we should do with Jesus. Now Jesus is about to stand before this very man who has that attitude. So him getting a fair trial, we know, is not going to happen. And so we know that from the very start. And perhaps that's why John even mentions Caiaphas at this point at verse 14. Now, John goes back and forth here. He's going to deal with Annas talking with Jesus, but he goes now to the denial of Peter. And then he's going to come back after a few verses to Jesus' situation with Annas. So verse 16 says, but Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Who do you think that other disciple is? Probably John. Very good. Probably John. Now, there's some dispute about that. It's almost unanimous that it's John, because That's how John would refer to himself. He would often not call himself by name. And in fact, if you look over in chapter 20, we'll get over there a little bit later. I think it's chapter 20, verse 2, says, so she ran and she went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. Now, we know who that is, the one whom Jesus loved. That's always a reference. That comes up, I can't remember, four or five times. That's always a reference to John. And here he's called the other disciple. Now, that's not conclusive. It's not like he couldn't refer to two different people as the other disciple. But most scholars believe that because of the nature of John and what he would normally do, not call himself by name, and because we know he is called the other disciple, that probably this is John. The reason why there's any doubt at all is because it says, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. So the question arises, how in the world did John know the high priest? And you know, have that kind of relationship with the high priest, a mere fisherman. And so some have concluded that maybe the other disciple was someone like Joseph of Arimathea or someone like that. Even, it's been mentioned, even Nicodemus. But most of the evidence, again, most conclude that it is John. And there could be various reasons why he knew, had a relationship, was close to the high priest somehow. But anyway, they go, Simon Peter followed with his other disciples. But it says Peter, verse 16, stood outside at the door. And so, you know, he didn't know the high priest, so he wasn't allowed in. And so the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door, which was obviously typical at time. We see in Acts chapter 12 that sort of thing. People who are wealthy would have maidens, would have servant girls who would stay watch at the door. So all of that is familiar to us, but it's kind of interesting. John is let in. Peter doesn't know the high priest, so he can't get in. And it's like John didn't even notice that Peter wasn't with him at first. So he goes on, and then he notices, where's Peter? And he goes back to get him. And then he reasons with the servant girl. And notice here, it says, so the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, you also are not one, or you also are not one of the man's disciples, are you? So the way that's worded, she almost expected the answer to be no. Like, she can't believe, are you? Like, you know, are you not one of them, are you? But she said also, which kind of indicates that she may have had an inclination that John was, or the other disciple, if it be John. She is halfway expecting a no there at the door. And he said, here's his first denial. He says, I am not. And it's interesting to me how casual we can read some of these things in the Gospels. And again, a lot of detail isn't going. But there is a direct denial of Christ. You disciple of Christ? I am not. Like, how would you view someone? If you knew I did that, how would you think of me? If you just found out, you know, Don, our preacher, someone asked him if he was a Christian. He said, no. That make you feel good? No. You'd probably want to rebuke me, wouldn't you? That's a flat out denial. On top of the fact that it's a lie. You know, all of this and this denial of Christ by Jesus, we emphasize the fact he's denying Christ, and certainly that's the most important part of it all. But in denying Christ, he was also a liar, because he was a disciple of Christ. He did know Jesus. How many of us might be ashamed? Maybe we wouldn't come right out and say, I am not. But how many of us try to disguise that, or not let people know that we are who we are? Are we ashamed of Christ in any form or fashion? Have you ever been less than honest when other people want to know who you are and why you behave the way you do? Have you ever, in your own life, denied Christ? And it's something that we need to remember. Jesus said, if you're ashamed of me, I will be ashamed of you. So we don't want to make the mistake that Peter made in denying Christ. Sometimes I think we can do the very thing. But he says, I am not. Verse 18, now the servants and the officer had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Now, he's going to drop off there, and again, he's going to get back to the situation with Jesus. And then he's going to pick back up where he leaves off, I think down about verse 18 or so, back at verse 25, rather. He's going to pick back up with that. But as you stop, and what comes to your mind, right, when you read this? What comes to your mind? The action of Peter. Very good. Right. I mean, he's going to get to his second and then third denial here in just a little bit. He just tells the story up to this point and he leaves off. But one of the things we should be asking ourselves right away is, or noticing, he's doing the very thing the Bible discourages us to do. He's keeping camp. He's associating with those who are enemies of Christ. And doing the very thing, you remember over in Psalms chapter 1, the opening of the book of Psalms, isn't he doing the very thing that the psalmist said not to do? Psalms 1 at verse 1, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. But no, we shouldn't keep company with those who are enemies of Christ. 1 Corinthians 15:33, of course. We realize that, and we talk about that all the time, but in real life, sometimes we find ourselves associating too much, altogether too much, with those who are really enemies of Christ or enemies of the truth, enemies of the church. We need to be careful. People influence us. And the point here, I suppose we could say from a certain standpoint that these people influenced Peter. More, though, he just did something bad because he was in a bad situation. Like, we'll find out later on. When he picks up on this, again, down about verse 25, we'll point out there's different kinds of sin, different kinds of temptation that overtakes us. And when we look at what went on with Peter, and you know, I'm about to say in his defense. Really, there is no defense for what Peter did, so that would be a poor choice of words. But just at least acknowledging that we're not altogether different than Peter. Like, sometimes when you have a sin like this, it's a sin that happens all at once. Like, he's standing there and warming himself by a fire, and then it seemed like just like that, they begin to accost him and ask him about if he knows Jesus. And he's almost unprepared for that. And he's just warming himself, and someone asks him a question. And, you know, a lot of times when sin kind of sneaks up on us like that, that's when we're most vulnerable. There's never an excuse to sin, so don't get me wrong. But that's when we're most vulnerable. If you'd ask me, if Peter were arrested and he was led before the Romans, standing side by side with Jesus, would he have been ready to die? Would he have denied knowing Jesus if he was bound up and taken? Probably not. Peter has already proven himself. He's ready to die for the Lord. But at this moment, in this situation, just bam, someone asked him about, and he was unprepared for it. Can kind of teach us a little bit about sin and how it attacks us, and we just have to keep the armor on all the time. Be alert and be ready all the time. It can come out of nowhere all at once. Give us some time to think about it, to think it through and get our defense together and kind of determine our mind how we're going to act in this situation or that situation. And we do pretty good. We have to learn to be quick and make decisions for God on the spot. Go ahead, Autumn, and then Paul. Yeah. Right. That's right. That's exactly right. That's a very good point. You know, that's Hebrews 6. We crucify Christ afresh. And that is right. For, you know, I mean, if we put them side by side, ours, when we deny Christ by sinning purposely, willfully, that's worse than what Peter did. That's hard for us to think, I can't admit. Well, I think Autumn's right. He was in a life, he could have been in a life-threatening situation. But the point of it is, we deny Christ. When we deny Christ by sinning, we're crucifying him afresh. Again, Hebrews 6 points that out. So, go ahead, Paul. Right.
And sometimes we don't count the cost.
Yes.
We go, hey, we can do this, we can do that, but when it comes down to it, when we really have to do it, it's harder than what we thought.
Yes. Very good. Very good. Anybody else? Miss any hands? Okay. All right, so let's, again, we don't want to find ourselves defending Peter at all. What he did was terrible. But again, sometimes we do terrible things ourselves. We'll look at that more as we get to it down at verse 19 or down a little bit further, 25. But verse 19 says, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Now, again, it's kind of up in the air there because of this relationship that Annas has and his position. The scholars are a little bit divided over who's under consideration here. Now, most believe, and I believe, that this is referring to Annas here. In fact, I think he is behind the whole thing. You want to know the truth about it? He is the authority there with regard to the Jews. He's the one that has the greatest influence. And so he's the one that has the power. But when you just read this, the high priest then questions Jesus. And some think then that he was led to Annas, but Caiaphas was there and he was dealing with Caiaphas. So, you know, there's some debate there. You have to look at that yourself. Come with you. Because of what is said in verse 13, and then when we get down to verse 24 in the ESV, and most modern translations say that Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. And I think the King James says that Annas had sent him. But that's not the weight of the evidence in the original isn't with that translation. The tense of the verb, that this is a better translation, verse 24. That being the case, it seems then, if that is true, then there's really no question but that he's dealing with Annas here. But again, it's nothing to be, you know, overly concerned with. But it appears that the high priest here is a reference to Annas. And so he questions Jesus about two things. He questions him about his disciples and about his teaching. And those are two very specific things that he questions him about because of what he's trying to do. The word question here, the Greek word means to interrogate. That's why I used that word earlier. That's what the Greek word means, to interrogate. He's interrogating Jesus. He's trying to get something out of Jesus. And there's two things. He asked about his disciples. Why? Because ultimately, what they want, these Jewish leaders, their mind is made up. We want Jesus dead. Like, this isn't about innocence or anything like that. It's not about right and wrong. It's about having Jesus killed. We want him gone. And so now he's asking about his disciples because the way they hope they can get rid of Jesus is by charging with him with sedition before the Romans. Like, he's this big troublemaker, and he's actually a threat to Rome. Now, if Jesus was going to be a threat to Rome, if there was going to be some kind of insurrection, and he was going to be the leader of this, what would Jesus need? Huh? Who said that? Soldiers. Soldiers. And whether they're official soldiers like the Romans have, or just a band of men who are willing to fight and die for him, he's going to need some men. And so the high priest asked him about his disciples. We're not told what he asked, but we know what they're after. We know what they want Jesus to be charged with. Again, it was an insurrection. So it's probably a question about his disciples, the number of disciples that he has, the power of his disciples. He's interrogating him. He wants to know. Then he can pass that information along and say, hey, this man is a threat. You need to do something about him. And hopefully put him to death since he's guilty of insurrection. And then, of course, that would be dealing with the Jews. Asking about his teaching, that would be more trying to get Jesus condemned by the Jews as a whole. They want to accuse him of blasphemy and his doctrine somehow contradicting Moses and so on. But these are two very specific things that Annas is interrogating Jesus about. And so that's what he's after. Now, it says, and Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I have said. So again, very good response by Jesus, but notice the calmness in which he responds. He is completely under control in this situation. And he knows the law. He knows exactly what's going on. He knows basically, even though this is an unofficial interrogation, again, the official trial won't begin until he actually stands before the real high priest, Caiaphas. So this is kind of like a preliminary situation of Annas just questioning him, trying to get something out of him. But still, Jesus knows his rights. He knows basically they don't have the right to ask him anything. Because in Judaism, they had a principle of Judaism that was pretty much like our Fifth Amendment. That is, you don't have to bear witness against yourself in some criminal case. If you have witnesses, bring them on. But you can't ask me to bear witness against myself. So that in itself was illegal for them to do. It wouldn't technically, because this was an official situation, I don't know. But Jesus knew his rights. And so he says to them, listen, I haven't done anything in secret. You must have some witnesses because here I am standing before you, bound me up and arrested me. So surely you have some witnesses. And beside, I haven't done anything in secret. And we know that to be the case, don't we? And when he says that, he doesn't mean, Jesus isn't saying, I mean, you can't hang on every word. And I mean, he spoke the way we speak. I mean, did Jesus ever have a private conversation with his disciples? Obviously. But you know what he's saying. His major doctrines were open. He spoke in the synagogues. Remember Luke chapter 4? I mean, there's a host of passages. Luke 4, verse 16. I think the record there, that's one time when he went into the synagogue. But there it said he went into the synagogue as his custom was. Telling us he regularly went into the synagogue and taught the Jews. And we've already seen what he did in the temple. He did teaching in the temple. He even cleansed the temple twice. So it's not like he's... Now, when you're thinking about someone who's an insurrectionist, someone who is trying to rebel against the power, the authority, what usually... The leader of that group, what's characteristic of him? You're trying to rebel. Someone like the Roman Empire. You're, huh? I'm sorry? Staying hidden. That is exactly right. Staying hidden. If you're leading a charge and at some point in time, you're going to attack the ones who are in authority, you're not telling the Romans, we're coming after you because you're about to get crushed. Your stain's hidden. It's a secret thing. So the very nature of Jesus and how he operated was against all of that. He let everybody know, this is what I'm teaching. This is my doctrine. Taught it in the synagogue. Taught it in the temple where all of the Jews regularly gathered. And so he just calmly tells them tells Annas that this whole charge is ridiculous. But watch very quickly before the bell rings here. It says, I've said nothing to say. Why do you ask me? Ask those. All right, verse 22. When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? Now, this is really when it begins. Jesus is struck. And again, I mean, to me, this is just as amazing from a standpoint of just reading this. This is as amazing to me as when Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. Like when we read that, you remember going over that. It's amazing that the Creator would take up a towel and wash his disciples' feet. And from a different point of view, for a totally different reason, this is just amazing. That the Son of God, the Creator, would allow himself to be struck in the face. And he responds very calmly. Like you wouldn't even probably do. I hope you would do that. I better take that back. I don't know what you would do. But most people, when they get hit in the face by someone, what do they do? Now, we're supposed to be different. But the fact of the matter is, your first inclination is to get mad. And what's very interesting is, we have this. Can you remember when this sort of thing happened on another occasion? Paul, that's exactly right. Rick, Paul was in this same situation before the high priest, Ananias, on that occasion, I believe. And he ordered Paul to be struck. We just have a couple minutes. Turn over to Acts chapter 23. And obviously keep your finger there. But now Paul, I mean, basically, I think most of us would agree. When we look at Paul, he was pretty much known as a man of self-control. He taught on self-control. He exercised self-control. He was a humble man. Like, we're never ashamed of how Paul acted, hardly ever. I mean, he made some mistakes that we know of, but I mean, he always handled himself well and behaved like Christians should behave. I'm just saying to you, he was a good man. But here was a good, godly man in the same situation as Jesus. And this is what he did. It says, and looking intently at the council, Paul said, brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. And watch, the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. He's saying, you hypocrite. Are you sitting in to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you ordered me to be struck? Now, let me just tell you, there's no sin in that. Paul certainly didn't sin in that, but his response is in contrast to Jesus, isn't it? A little bit. Like, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm kind of with Paul. You tell him, Paul. You tell him. They were hypocrites. And it was wrong what they did to Paul. He didn't deserve that in any form and fashion. And him telling them that, there was nothing wrong with that. But it is a little bit different when you flip back over to John and you see Jesus, the exact same thing happened. And he didn't call him a hypocrite or anything like that. He responds in a much calmer fashion. And so it just, again, the self-control of Jesus is just amazing. How he endured things like this and remained calm, because he knew everything that was happening and why it was happening. And he did. We'll get to it next week. But he did respond to them a little bit, and demanded that some witnesses be brought forth. And that's okay. When you're mistreated, you can respond. The question is, how are you going to respond? And so just very interesting contrast there. All right, we'll pick up there next week.